This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 31st of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to the greatest hits of Section D in 2013. Coming up today, we cast our net back over the last 12 months of Section D, fishing over the festivals and news, the designers and creative pioneers that have kept our ears pricked each week here on the show. For this greatest hits, we'll naturally start with a show-stopping opening act and head to Milan.
We're faced with the challenge of how to present furniture and how to bring it to life digitally because these pieces are so extraordinary and you can really only appreciate them if you're in person with them.
We'll be looking back again at tropical modernism in both Sao Paulo and, rather less expectedly, Ghana's capital city of Accra.
It's always cool in here. There's always plenty of light. It's just about the best building that could ever be designed for young children with their short attention span and their need for movement.
And then we'll bring you selections of the best interviews the Section D team conducted in 2013. In addition to the Design Miami founder Ambra Meda, Nokia's then design VP Marco Artisari, and the Fantastic Man boys, we also chat to architect Sue Fujimoto in our stellar lineup of Q&As.
This grid structure is a really artificial, transparent, sharp edge, but at the same time, the whole shape and the whole experience is more organic and soft, like a cloud.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. As you've just heard, this is a special best-of edition of Section D. We trawled through some of our travels and travails of the last year and fished out the moments that deserve to be dusted off once more. We'll head back to the Salone del Mobile in Milan, from where Section D anchored two shows last spring.
Even here, you'll see couples pinching and zooming with their heads down. We have the goal to design for people to have their head up again.
And explore how passionate protest over urban design and architecture can foster revolution in Turkey. And we'll revisit Lisbon, where architecture is facing the challenge of adapting to Portugal's weak economy.
People are afraid of doing rehabilitation, renewal and construction, and think it's really difficult and costs a lot of money. So we need to give this information to people that step by step, it's not that difficult.
More recently, we take a tour of Europe's most exciting design festivals. Sir John Sorrell explains the inspiration behind London's, while Eindhoven's Philips Legacy provides an exciting backdrop to contemporary Dutch design.
De oude gloeilampenfabriek kreeg het eerste aandacht.
The future is about combining the left half and the right half of your brain. Bring in the nerds, bring in the creatives, and them together will bring the solutions for the future.
It's been a busy year. Whether you're into industrial, product, graphic or urban, design bubbles along affecting us all. We've tried our best to cover the big, bizarre and brilliant stories from the last year. Enjoy. Let's start near the beginning. Section D decamped to Milan to cover Salone del Mobile back in April. And our first guest is no stranger to design fairs. Ambra Meda, in fact, set up her very own one, Design Miami, in 2005. It caught and propelled the wave of design art into something of a phenomenon. And Meda is credited with pushing design into a new realm, adding cachet, glamour, and even a dose of celebrity to the industry. Meda left her post at Design Miami in 2010. She didn't take early retirement, though. She's in fact been busier than ever. She joined Hugo McDonald to tell him exactly what she's been up to.
So we've been very busy in the last year and a half setting up what is going to be my new business, which is l'arcobaleno.com. It's a website that is presented as a magazine online, and there is e-commerce. So we'll be creating a lot of content, video, lots of stories about design and what's happening. And it's extremely curated. I'll be curating objects from all over the world. So anything from baskets from Botswana to houses by Prouvé, and the pieces will be for sale, and we launch in May.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah,
you
I'm
must
very
be having
excited.
Quite a lot of sleepless nights at the moment, I'm sure, getting
I am
that together.
I'm very underslept right now.
This whole sort of juxtaposition between online, which seems to have more of a presence, sort of digital companies, versus this complete return to craft, which all seems to be happening together in the same spaces, even during this Salone. Is it a geographical division, do you think, that in America, where obviously tech seems to rule, versus Europe, slightly more old-fashioned, maybe a little bit stuck in ruts, some would say, where we are still talking and obsessed with people making things with their hands and selling in a traditional way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, technology is today's craft. And so in a way, it's really just supporting what is happening both in digital and human terms. Definitely, America is so much more online oriented. I think people are just so much more used to shopping online. I mean, I even do my grocery shopping online, which is something that I never thought I would do. And people are just more, you know, they're online all day. Mm. I've been in Europe pretty much since January, and I have to say, just talking about the new business, speaking to people in Europe, they do seem to have not a resistance, but they just don't have it. It's not quite under their belt yet.
Yeah, reservations and a sort of apprehension.
Absolutely. Mm. But it's quite clearly the future, and I think it's already happening. It's not like this is the next thing. It's already here.
I mean, quite a lot of the debate that we have at Monocle surrounds the fact that when people sort of move into a virtual or digital world, that some of the sort of charm is lost between human interaction. I mean, service primarily is sort of killed if you're only ever really buying things with a click of a mouse. Is that an old-fashioned argument, do you think? Or is it something that we
I think it
need
will
to be careful not to kill?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be an old-fashioned argument quite soon. But I think, you know, face-to-face is unbeatable. That's, you know, there's no question about it. And, you know, we're faced with the challenge of how to present furniture and how to bring it to life digitally, because these pieces are so extraordinary and you can really only appreciate them if you're in person with them.
Amber Medder there. And across the hall, Hugo caught up with a man tasked at that point with bringing the buzz back to Nokia through design. Salone is not just about furniture. It's a good litmus test for the future of the way we might live too. While we were there, Finnish brands Iittala and Nokia held an event to discuss the future of communication in everyday life. It's no easy task. Marco Artisari, Nokia's then vice president of design, was speaking at the event. He told Hugo what the future held.
One of the things I think everybody that you've seen here is struggling with is how to keep your smartphones charged at Salone.
Tell me about
And what we've done is we've led the way with wireless charging, essentially something we do every day, a repeated pattern. You just lay the phone on a charging pad, and now by embedding it even in other everyday objects, charging becomes part of the environment. So we take interactions that normally would require much more effort and
cables,
planning, now becomes something very just serendipitous. You lay it down and charge it. And I think this is one trend, is that these things that you do every day will just become embedded into the environment. They'll be more glanceable in terms of the user interface, is not requiring so much effort and attention. And it was well received.
There seems to be a very clear divide between either incorporating technology into your way of life in a way that actually declutters it somehow, or returning to something that is very craft-based and tactile and sort of in many ways completely eschewing technology and mastering skills that connect people to nature all over again. I mean, these two tenets are really at the heart of Finnish design as well, and something that you yourself have really tried to incorporate into Nokia. How's that going?
I think if we look at the identity of our new Nokia Lumia product, so there's a certain purity there, taking away everything unnecessary, but you're still left with something that has warmth to it, that has a humanness. And in the studio, we actually talk about very seriously and that technology should make us more human. And if you really take that seriously, that's a very tall order. So we were talking a little bit earlier about glanceable user interfaces or interfaces that don't require more attention. You walk even here in, let's say, this wonderful tea room here, you'll see couples pinching and zooming with their heads down. We have the goal to design for people to have their head up again. What does that mean? It means better glanceable user interfaces, more mechanical user interfaces to the digital. So I think the interesting thing about the technology industry, it has huge waves. And these waves are typically, there are a few companies controlling a certain way, but we're going to see layers into everyday life of more devices and products that are dedicated. They're smaller, closer to the skin on us, in us, with us, that will do one or two things really well, and these will have mechanical interfaces. So I think that trend is important. The other one is personalization. You said it. How does it go into structure? With my Nokia Lumia, if you even take a look at screen here, it's all full of people. And these are the people I communicate with most, and it's all centered around the people, places, and actions I do every day, not apps. So it's not screens of apps where you have to, which one was that one I needed to check, but rather it disintegrates into the actions that you want to do and personalizing that.
Marco Artisari, Nokia's Vice President of Design there. Next, we're on to publishing. Now, in an age where publishing can take the form of 140 characters, a post on a blog, or the more old-fashioned form of actual print media, it's heartening to see that some magazines still stand out from the crowd for the time and care taken to put together a publication of real quality. Fantastic Man is one such magazine. From its launch in 2005, it continues to celebrate a partnership between good design and journalism, and distinguishes itself thanks to everything from the layout, use of font colours, to the approach of its interviews. Section D producer Aled John caught up with the editors and founders, Jop van Bennekom and Gert Jonkers, to find out how design plays a crucial role in the success of their media brand.
I think increasingly we've been made into an example how it could be successful, editorial design. You know, it's also something that's, let's say, fairly new, something of the last 10 years where editorial design actually really became a discipline in its own almost.
We really don't know how to do it differently. It's not that we designed a model to work.
No.
It's like, this is the way we do it, and we don't know how to do it differently. So that's the way we do it, and is what we do, you know, the combination of a very editorial approach to design or a very design approach to editorial. Is that a new model? Well, maybe. I mean, I think it works for us, but it really works for us because it works for us.
I just hope, because there's more publications where people from different disciplines got together creating a magazine. Take, for instance, Appartamento, which is a photographer and an editor, and then a visual language. And the style of the photography became kind of like very central to what the magazine actually is. So I think the world needs editors. I think the world needs people that actually choose and edit, you know.
I've read in the past you've talked about your preferred inclusivity of Fantastic Man, rather than the kind of exclusive nature of magazines as a whole to an extent. Do you see there's a balance to be had between the kind of niche market that you're focusing on and the kind of inclusivity that you've talked about?
There is something contradictory to the fact that we want to be inclusive, yet we turn out to be quite a niche publication. It's not very contradictory to us because that's what we do. You know, the whole idea of exclusivity and sort of excluding people is not interesting to us. If you talk about exclusive as something that is not mass market and it's not sort of thrown in your face and it's not all over the world, yes, we are in a way exclusive.
But I think a lot of magazines are very much defined by just representing everything, you know, not making choices and be friends with everybody in the industry. So I do think we make a little bit more of a selection and much more of a personal edit than most magazines do.
What's the magic of design involved in the production of Fantastic Man and The Gentlewoman?
Well, I think the magic is of the design is that it's hardly there. It's a very formal language in both magazines of just typography and rule lines. It's very simple. It just puts photography next to text, and it has a headline, and it tries to create magic with just a few ingredients. What a magic is, I cannot read.
Well, I think the magic is that it's really good, but that's I can say that easier because I don't do the actual design.
Gert Jonkers finishing that interview there. And staying in the Netherlands, situated in the heart of Amsterdam in a small building attached to a medieval church, the studio space of the two-man graphic design team at Manschaft. It isn't the most typical setting to meet a contemporary design partnership. As part of our regular peep into the working lives of designers across the world and the music that inspires them, we went to meet Manschaft's Andreas Schloffel and Rob Meermann at their studio.
My name is Rob Meermann. I'm a graphic designer, and you're in my office of my company called Manschaft.
I'm his business partner. My name is Andreas Schloffel. We are in the oldest part of the city, right in the center. And we are surrounded by the famous Red Light District. And we find ourselves like glued right alongside the old church, the oldest building of Amsterdam. And I always say we are actually in the intersection between flesh and spirit, let's say, because we have on the one hand side we can see the prostitutes, and on the other side we can hear a church choir sing, perform.
So we think this our office was actually the house of the bell ringer of the old church, and you can see it's wonderful because it's sort of wrapped around the choir of the church. It's a bit like a boat. If you walk around, you can hear the floorboards creak. And here's a bit of church bumping into our office. This must have been some sort of, we've made a little library here. The wet space, you can even have a shower here. And this is where we usually have meetings, but I think it was a former bedroom. We really love this office because it has 12 windows opening up to the water, to this canal, which is a very busy canal. The fun thing is that you're inside, but you're always outside because there's so much to see outside because there's water.
Yeah,
that's actually one of the best things. Yeah, being right in the heart of the city means that so many people drop by.
Everything is walking distance. Dam Square, Central Station, U-Markt, the shopping area. So when friends are in the neighborhood, they give us a ring. Are you available? And then we meet up. So even if you have a busy period, there's always a way to break out for a moment without hassle. So, yeah, I got a tip when I was buying a bread at a bread shop, and the guy behind the counter, he told me, you really have to listen to the Wild Beast. So he gave me the CD, and I'm putting it on the studio, and we got kind of addicted to it, and then we also went to the concert. So it's very funny how it can go, and when we are kind of confident about a project and it's going well, and then we put the music on.
Wild Beast, The Devil's Crayon from the first album Limbo Panto, ending that insight into the studio of Manshaft. You're listening to a special best of edition of Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Coming up, design festivals across Europe, glass houses in Brazil, and the origins of the anti-government protests in Turkey. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
What became a nationwide protest against perceived autocracy began as an architectural and urban planning dispute concerning a government plan to redevelop Gezi Park, known as the Taksim Pedestrianization Project. I've come to Istanbul to find out how still 2 months later, the argument that underlies the ongoing protest concerns the design of the city, why architecture plays a fundamental role in the social issues of Istanbul, and how Gezi and Taksim are now bywords for public discontent.
My name is Murat Çetin, I'm an architect and also I'm an academic. I work at Kadir Has University in Istanbul as an associate professor, and I took part in the protests.
Murat Çetin was a member of the protest camp from day one. He takes me on a tour of the area, beginning in Taksim Square. In terms of the actual project that the government was planning, I know it was a huge part of Erdogan's election manifesto. Yeah. The pedestrianisation of Gezi Park. To an outsider such as myself, that doesn't sound like such a bad thing. Yeah. The pedestrianisation, it's quite a nice title. It evokes
kind of green spaces. It evokes no traffic. Can you explain why this was received so badly? Was it the lack of consultation, or was there more to it than that?
Partly the lack of consultation, but the government is very talented and very conscious about the user of catchy words like pedestrianization. Yes, it sounds very good, but the actual project was not a pedestrianization project at all, because in order to take the massive traffic here, you need to excavate approximately 6 major tunnels around the square, and they have to be at least 2-lane each. And if you look at the streets and the width of the streets, you can see that they are not that big. So once these tunnels are excavated all around the square, for pedestrians, there is only about 1.5 meters to walk. I think these are deliberate acts of gentrifying this area and removing its ties with the surrounding settlements, and especially those people who are not very accepted by the government.
So looking at the events that happened over the last 2 months,
yes.
How involved were you in the events?
It was a part of the construction project that is going on for excavating the tunnels connecting Tarlabaşı Square to Harbiye area. This was again faced with a lot of reactions from especially Chamber of Architects, because it was destroying the unity of this whole area. So while they were constructing this tunnel, they started to remove some of the trees, although it was not in the project. We started the protests not for these trees only, because of the whole public works project going on around Taksim Square. We were defending the public space, because all these transformations, and especially the shopping mall project, was kind of destroying the public nature of the park. So we were protesting against that. And that day, they started to remove a couple of trees on the very end of this park. And it all started with that. But the next day, they came with the tear gases and water cannons at the very early hours, around 5 o'clock in the morning, while people were sleeping here. So they continued.
Murat Çetin ending that report. A snippet of the full hour-length documentary by our producer, Aled John. Later in the programme, Aled investigated the political legacy and contemporary design and architectural issues at play on two of the prince's islands on the Bosphorus.
To experience the islands firsthand, I hire a private boat with the help of Bodgazada islander İpek Özge. İpek is a sociologist and member of the local forum group. Yasada is a one-hour trip away by boat. As you approach, the shells of the former institutions built there loom over the shoreline.
The government sees these areas as empty, vast, unused areas. Like, they don't see common spaces as places that there's life in. It's the same as other parks, same as other rivers. So we are saying this place is not empty. This place is not an unused economic good. The idea is to emphasize it, and it's very much relates to what we were wanting in Gezi movement as well. It's the same thing. The park is not empty area that you can use it as a profitable place. Like, what we showed in Gezi Park is that Taksim is not empty.
As with the trees of Gezi Park, the ecological issues represented by Sivriada are overshadowed by the political symbolism of Yesada's history. On the island, İpek takes me up to the makeshift courtroom that housed the trial of Adnan Menderes.
So this is an old sports hall, which was converted into the courthouse for the trial of the former Prime Minister, Adnan Menderes. It's hard to describe this place. There's seats on the side as if people could watch. This is really something. So there's graffiti on all the walls in Spanish and Turkish. No pasarán, don't pass here. And there's remnants of the old sporting equipment, ropes hanging from the ceilings that could have been used for trapeze or... And there's a basketball hoop, what was a stand for a basketball hoop. You really get the sense that this is a forgotten chapter of Turkey's history. It's the place where they put on trial their former prime minister. No small event, but what was the courthouse, a former sports hall, has been left to rot.
I wonder why the government is willing to pass a law that would allow the levelling of an island of such historical symbolism, when Erdogan often refers to himself as a latter-day Menderes, an Islamist leader of Turkey, at odds with the military establishment.
Aled reporting from the island of Yasser Adda there. You can, of course, see the full documentary on episode 95 of Section D. This is a special best-of edition of Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, from Turkey to Brazil. Sao Paulo is known for seemingly never-ending skyline of concrete high-rises. But in the middle of the upscale neighbourhood Morumbi, architecture aficionados can find the Glass House. It was the home of the legendary Sao Paulo-based architect, Lina Bobardi, and it now acts as a museum of her life and career. Monocle correspondent Sheena Rossiter was invited to visit the Glass House to take a glimpse into the illuminating life of Lina Bobardi.
Because of the house's location in the middle of what was once a rainforest, natural elements have caused the stilted structure to erode faster than normal. 7 years ago, the Glass House had to be closed for 3 years for renovations. And because of the structure's delicate nature, visits to the Glass House can only be made by appointment and in groups no larger than 12 people. The only exception was this past April when Swiss curator Hans Urich hosted a 50-day exhibition at the house, which received around 10,000 visitors. Renato Anelli explains the main challenges the institute has with maintaining the house.
We work with the preservation of the house. It is very tough to maintain this house because we have many difficult situations in the middle of these trees. This is really a rainforest garden, so the humidity here is very bad. Okay, let's go upstairs. We can show you the house.
As we head out of the remote studio, tucked away in the rainforest garden, we make our way up several sets of stairs to the living room, a vast open space that's flooded with natural life with its floor-to-ceiling windows. Here, we take a look at several of her sketches and furniture, which was designed by Lina herself.
It's nice, no? This was her bedroom.
Around the corner and down the hall, we head to her bedroom, one of the few rooms in the house that isn't full of the archives. But just like the living room, it's also full of furniture that she designed.
How would you describe her type of style here for the bed and tables?
How can I describe it? I think it's a kind of funny design in the beginning of her career. You can find this design in the illustrations of the magazines she designed.
As Renato takes us outside the house, behind the kitchen and into the back section of the seemingly never-ending garden, we overlook Sao Paulo's Faria Lima, a business district which surely didn't exist when Lina and Pedro built the house. But after touring around the 7,000 square meter property, it wouldn't be fair to call the Glass House or Casa do Vidro a house, but rather a piece of design history which teaches all of those who visit not just about Brazil's history of modernist design, but also allows you to take a peek into the life of one of the great minds behind it, Lina Bobardi. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Coming up, we speak to Su Fujimoto about his design of London's Serpentine Pavilion. We meet some of the world's leading graphic designers at the Alliance Graphique Internationale and head to Eindhoven's Dutch Design Week. All that and a lot more. But first, let's look to Africa and the role of modernist architecture in post-colonial cities. Monocle's Accra correspondent, Christopher Lord, takes a look at the relics of this era of exchange in Ghana and assesses the condition of these buildings today.
When the Union Jack came down in Accra in 1957, to be replaced with the tropical tricolour flag of independent Ghana, the country's first president, Kwame Nkrumah, founded the country on an incurable taste for the modern. He wanted jazz or highlife bands to play the unofficial anthems of this new country. He sent young Ghanaians abroad to bring back the best technical and medical expertise that the West and Soviet Union could offer. And, most visibly, he invited a new wave of foreign architects to the country, who could express this free African nation in the clean and progressive lines of modernism. The buildings from this era of so-called tropical modernism remain around Accra, but without any push to protect and restore these buildings, many of them are looking a little worse for wear. Take the Children's Library, designed by Maxwell Fry, one of Britain's most important post-war architects. It may still be standing, but it's lacking books, going largely unused, and is in desperate need of a spruce up. On the circular ramp at the entrance to the library, I meet Nat Amatefio, a former mayor of Accra and an architect who's currently writing a history of this city's buildings.
This children's library opened in 1957, around the time of our independence. The walls are composed mainly of louvre glass windows. So it's always cool in here. There's always plenty of light. It's just about the best building that could ever be designed for young children with their short attention span and their need for movement. This complex is called Nkrumah Flats, named quite obviously after Kwame Nkrumah, who was the first president and founder of the country. And he had this place built for middle level as well as senior civil servants. It consists of about 4-6-story apartment buildings clad in black and white with all the vocabulary of the modernist tropical design, that a lot of slats, openings in wall to allow for airflow, and louvre windows all over. It's a bright and airy structure. What is fascinating about this particular area is it has retained its original design advantages. It's extremely green, full of birds. Unfortunately, it looks very disheveled and unkempt because it's not being maintained as it should.
Amatefio is concerned if the work of these tropical modernists isn't maintained, then a vital part of the narrative of architecture here will be erased. For Monocle, in Accra, I'm Christopher Lord.
You can, of course, hear more from Christopher Lord on the show. His report can be found on episode 86. We're back after this short break to hear from Sue Fujimoto, the architect behind this year's London Serpentine Pavilion.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Architecture doesn't have to be permanent, and sometimes the freshness and immediacy of a contemporary creation has a unique appeal all of its own. Every year, London's Serpentine Gallery invites an international architect to complete a structure that shows the very best of his or her talent and also brings new world architecture to the UK. Since the annual project's inception in the year 2000, the Serpentine Pavilion has become a byword for the best of contemporary architecture. And for 4 months during the summer, the pavilion becomes one of London's most exciting cultural nerve centres. Monocle's David Pleasant went along to meet the architect of this year's pavilion and some of the other people behind its construction.
My name is David Glover. I'm the chief executive for AECOM Building Engineering, and this year I've led the team for the design and of the Serpentine Pavilion.
With this pavilion in particular, you really feel a kind of engineered aspect of it. Tell us a bit about what went into putting this together. It's quite complex, isn't it?
It is a very complex pavilion. You know, it's got over 10,500 nodes. It's got 27,000 members. And one of the things is the speed of the Serpentine Pavilion, which, to be quite honest, is something I've always enjoyed, because you go from that very early concept in January to opening on the 4th of June is always going to be a challenge. And I think the thing here is that this is such a complex building that we ended up having to work totally in 3D with this. And we also had 4,000 miles between Sue's team in Tokyo and ours in London, and also the fabricators up in Yorkshire, that fundamentally we had to work 24/7. We used to do a 12-hour shift, they would do a 12-hour shift, and we would play with the structure and the form so that we could make sure we had the best seating, the structure could work and stand up, and at the same time end up working with the fabricators to make sure that we could actually manufacture every one of those nodes and members in the 6 weeks fabrication time they had. But equally, from Sue's point of view and ours, it was really important that the design intent was retained, And, you know, I think you can see from the pavilion, it really does feel like that's been the case. So we worked immensely hard with SO to make sure that we made sure that the joints looked monolithic. We could build it in the factory because of the wonderful English weather early in the year wasn't going to allow you to build it on site. And, you know, Ted only has this site for 6 weeks before he has to lay all the foundations and erect it. So we had 17 truckloads of, I think, 54 modules come down the road. They were craned in place, fixed in place, and made to look totally in this monolithic manner.
I'm Su Fujimoto from Tokyo, and now I'm just in front of the Serpentine Summer Pavilion 2013, the this year pavilion, and I designed this pavilion.
It's been described as a cloud, many things. How would you describe it? What was your idea behind this pavilion?
We could say this is an artificial cloud or artificial forest or something like that. Because my intention is to create something between nature and architecture. So these pavilions are made by grids, by thin steel structures. It's made by really, really many, many grids. And this grid structure is a really artificial, transparent, sharp edge. But at the same time, the whole shapes and the whole experience is more organic and soft, like a cloud. So try to create nice integrations, nice mixtures of the nature things and the artificial things together.
Now, graphic designers from across the world gathered in London this autumn for the AGI London Open. Typographers, book designers and graphic artists from the music and film industries descended on the city's Barbican Centre to gauge the temperature of graphic design today. AGI, or the Alliance Graphique Internationale, was founded in 1954 as a forum for the world's leading graphic artists. Membership is by invitation only, and those who make up the organisation today work in all branches of graphic design, all over the world.
The speakers here at the two-day event represent most of the branches of graphic design: typographers, poster and book designers, and creatives from the magazine and film industries are all here. Events like this one are designed to give those starting out in the industry a toehold in an increasingly shifting field. Digital design may have democratized the industry. Anyone, anywhere can now pretty much design something and share it online. But it's also, in many ways, saturated the design landscape. As Tony Brook, graphic designer and UK president of ARGI, tells me.
Well, there are always things to be concerned about. You're always driving to be better, but it's in fantastically rude health. I think it's actually a golden period. And I think that, personally, I think that computers have had a huge hand in that. That more work has been made, there's more bad work has been made, but there's also more good work, and the good work is really pushing boundaries and really challenging us. And so I think we're in a very, very good situation right here, right now.
Graphic design might be becoming a more competitive field, but those commissioning work are also getting more choosy. Marion Bunches again.
7-8 years ago, I was really sticking out for doing something new. And then, you know, a lot of people started doing similar things. And I'm sort of constantly moving myself ahead. I'm constantly changing my work. Quite frankly, they don't have the awe for the work that they used to have. And so they're more difficult to please.
Everything from typeface to the design of book covers and LP sleeves are up for grabs here.
So how does jazz, typography and graphic design combine into this, you know, obsession? How many people, show hands, has today in their home a record, an LP, a vinyl record?
The mood here in London is upbeat, but there is a very quiet sense of nervousness here too.
To see 2,000 young designers is fantastic. My only worry is that because it is such a big industry and there are not enough spaces within that industry, what are they all going to end up doing? You know, I think having a creative education is great because they can take that anywhere, you know, end up in whatever sphere, and it'll be useful. Better than, you know, all those people sitting in the city pushing numbers around. I much prefer to hang out with creative people every time.
And those creatives have another, more pressing question to pose the 2,000 young designers here as the conference draws to a close.
One last question before we close. This is anonymous. How important are jazzy socks to the design process?
The industry might be filling up, but the advice is clear. Get a pen, a book, and a pair of jazzy socks, and you're ready to make your way in graphic design. Paint me a picture. For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis. Paint me a picture.
More from Thomas on the AGI Open in episode 104. And from graphics to grand designs. This year's Lisbon Architecture Triennale, part celebration of new talent, part call to arms for a generation adapting to the reality of the recent economic crisis. In September, it hosted a number of events and workshops aiming to remind young architects that there is work to be had. David Pleasant took to the streets to find those championing innovation to change the status quo.
My name is Joanna, I'm from Arteria, the office, and my project is about the view we are setting here. We are in Praça da Figueira. It's a square with a lot of empty buildings around us. And this happens because people are afraid of doing rehabilitation, renewal and construction, and think it's really difficult and costs a lot of money.
So you're documenting every empty building in Lisbon, is that right?
We're constructing a database of the empty buildings all around Lisbon. We have this beta phase already done of Pena, this district behind us. And we are documenting all these empty buildings. We are calling real estates to understand where they are and to show them to people, show the pictures.
I'm interested in, if we're talking about design, how do we relate your skills as a designer, as an architect? What are you trying to do with this project? How do you kind of make that transition? How do you kind of tie the two together?
Arteria Studio is about rehabilitation only. So we do what we have to do as architects, being our age in Lisbon. And somehow architects were very interested in the past few years in new construction. And by many reasons, Lisbon is in this state right now. So we decided we have to picture this territory.
Do you feel as architects your skills as designers are more urgently needed?
Yes, it is. Also, it's a work that has not been developed. So you have somehow, it's raw material. We have raw material.
That was Ana Jara at Arteria Studio.
My name is Manuel Henriques, and I'm the executive director of the Lisbon Architecture Triennale. Well, I think people are definitely reacting because they now have no other choice. I could say that when we started to feel the crisis in our homes, in our jobs, in our offices, and then in 2011, it started to really feel like very strong. It was not only your friends, not friends of friends, it was already you and your very close friends. So I think everybody is finding other ways of living, and not only, of course, they reduced a lot their offices, manpower reduced a lot, and there were a lot of architects that started teaching and that were not teaching before. Really a very big amount or number of architects, mostly the younger generation, just went away and to other countries to look for jobs.
The economic crisis has hit Portugal's architects hard, drastically reducing commissions, and an almost total collapse in public projects has led to thousands of job losses, and many to pack up their bags and move to Brazil, Angola, or even further afield. Many who remain, however, are not going to take the crisis lying down. Many see this as an opportunity and feel an immense sense of duty to keep designing, whether that's designing solutions rather than buildings. Many of Lisbon's architects are managing how to make use of limited resources and are helping to create new visions for the future of their city.
Don't forget, a full special issue on the Lisbon Architecture Triennale is available via our website at monocle.com. Next up, we're off to Eindhoven for Dutch Design Week.
Taking over much of Eindhoven proper, large chunks of the nine-day event took over the former factories of technology giants Philips, which founders Gerard and his father Frederick grew in light of their first and immensely successful product, the incandescent lamp, in 1891.
De oude gloeilampenfabriek kreeg het eerste aandacht. Een gevelsteen herinnert eraan hoe Gerard Philips daar de eerste lampen maakte. En het was hier dat ingenieur Frits Philips een grote krans plaatste om deze pionier te eren.
And as you might expect, the air is full of excitement. Unsurprising maybe when over 2,000 designers and much fanfare has taken over the town. With the new crop of emerging talent, social activism is never far away from what's on offer.
Simply because electronic devices are not designed to last. This makes electronic waste one of the fastest growing waste streams in the world, and our phone is one of the biggest causes. So this is a new kind of phone.
While many designers let the quality of their work speak for itself.
Dutch design is just making nice products, good products. They have to be everlasting, you know?
Over the week, we've endeavoured to meet with some of the thinkers behind the event, which has taken on a new guise under the leadership of its director, Martijn Paulen.
We are a Philips town with a lot of high tech, with ASML, with a high tech campus, with a technical university. And I honestly believe that the future is about combining the left half and the right half of your brain. Bring in the nerds, bring in the creatives, and them together will bring the solutions for the future. And that's where designers will play an important role. And we have that DNA right here in the heart of our city. That's why I think you can look into the future here.
Eindhoven has an extraordinary legacy of design, obviously a very strong technical base. Do you think Eindhoven has undergone something of an identity change over the time that Philips has staggered its move to the Far East?
Definitely, definitely. 20 years ago, we had about 90,000 people working in the city for Philips. And now it's maybe 7 or 8,000. So, and Philips really built this town, so it was in the heart of our town. And that created a rift through our city. It was all open spaces, empty buildings, old buildings. And then we had a government that said, look, we are training the best technicians, we're training the best designers, or educating the best designers in the world, at least that's what we think. Why not give them a place to stay and settle and build a community, a creative community? And now you see that really in the heart of our town, well, you've been walking around, you see that all the buildings are occupied with creatives. And this is kind of, it's an effect that it works like glue, like honey. People, it attracts others, and you know, the community is still growing very, very fast, and it's thriving.
With interviews at Eindhoven Design Academy, Philips Lighting, and the best of the designers on display at Dutch Design Week, the Section D special is worth a listen. And finally, let's go out with a big name interview. During our coverage of London Design Festival, I sat down with a man who co-founded the event, Sir John Sorrell. The chairman of LDF, Sir John's 40-year career ranges from the creation of one of Europe's biggest and most successful design businesses to his current role as a UK business ambassador. He told me what inspired him to establish the festival all those years ago, over a nice cup of tea in the Monocle Cafe.
I was looking at different things that the council might do, and I had a shopping list, which I've still got, written in pencil, and one of them was the London Design Festival. But I won't go bore you with all the details, but other things overtook it, and I revived the idea in 2002 when I was asked to do the Theo Crosby Memorial Lecture at the Globe Theatre. And the subject was the creative cities. And I talked about London being the world's greatest creative city, and I said it's about time we had a great design festival. And everyone said, when are you going to do it? So I was kind of, it's an old saying, isn't it? Put your money where your mouth is. So I talked to a few friends, including Ben Evans, who had worked with me at the Design Council. And to cut a very long story short, we spent a year planning it and did the first one in 2003.
What do you think kind of sets the London Design Festival and just the whole sort of design week in general on the sort of international calendar, which is pretty jam-packed now? What makes it unique?
Well, the calendar didn't used to be jam-packed. Do you know how many festivals and design weeks there were in the world before we started, 2003? Well, since we started, there's 100 cities created a design festival or a design week, and every single one of them have come to see the London Design Festival, and they've gone back and set theirs up. The British Council brings over every year about 30 or so design directors of other festivals. We get invited everywhere in the world to go and talk at their festivals because they see that this is where it all originated, and it's absolutely great to see them. Where does the London Design Festival sit? Well, I think it's very different. It's different for a number of reasons. First of all, We use London as the stage. That's the idea. If you think of London as the stage for a great festival of design, so it's on the streets. It's not just in a shed.
Yeah.
And a lot of design weeks or design festivals tend to take place in one big building where they put on an exhibition trade show, really. They sell stands and they do a little conference. But what I like about our festival is that it's here, there and everywhere, which was the campaign theme this year. And it's tiny, it pops up in designer studios, it's in places like the V&A, it's in museums, it's in galleries, it's in places like Monocle, it's absolutely everywhere. I don't know another where in the world that's like that. And Milan, which I love, is still very much a what you might call a trade show. It hasn't really seeped in the way that London does. And the other thing that's very different about London is that it's got such an international audience. If you look at the roll call of people doing things over this week or so, look at the names. They're from 50, 60, 70 different countries.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that makes it exciting for me. And the other thing is that we go right across the whole range of design disciplines. So again, you know, that's unusual because most people concentrate on one or two. So there's a lot of design events around the world which are about what, you know, what you like furniture, lighting, textiles. It's about it, really. Mm. But we try to cover everything: digital, engineering, architecture, fashion, a bit of everything, really, during the festival. And that's what, of course, is what London is about anyway, is what I believe is the greatest design city in the world.
I'm sort of thinking about the other 51 weeks of the year. What is the sort of design industry like at the moment in London?
Well, the design industry is not immune from recession. Mm. I've been through about five during my career. But the point about the design industry, it's always at the forefront of regeneration, because everyone in the end goes to designers, whatever discipline, to create the new ideas which are going to get them out of the recession and make them more money.
Yeah.
So the design industry is always a few steps in front of the game. And I'm looking around now, talking to people, and I can see some very definite signs that people are, you know, doing a bit better than they were last year, and that's a bit better than the year before. There was a very difficult period 3-4 years ago where there are a lot of redundancies and a lot of people in trouble. I think that's changing, and I think it's because in the end you've got to turn to design, because how else can you differentiate? Only one can be the cheapest, and you're certainly not going to win by putting thousands more people on a job. The only way you can be better and be best is to design.
Sir John Sorrell talking to me there. And that's your lot, a whistle-stop tour of some of the standout moments from the past year. It's been a good one. I hope you've enjoyed the show through 2013. We'll be back on the other side of the calendar with more stories from around the world. Today's show was produced by Aled John and, as always, edited by the wonderful Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com. I'm Tom Morris. And playing you out, to close what's been an action-packed 2013 on Section D, here's Tori Amos with the eternally reflective Pretty Good Year. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.
Greggy writes letters and burns his CDs. They say you are something in those formative years. Well, hold on to nothing as fast as you can. Well, still pretty good, yeah. Pretty good. Maybe a bright sandy beach is gonna bring you back, back.